The perfect combination of versatile athleisure and training apparel has arrived. Thanks to the visionary minds of New Balance, Clutch Athletics, and Rich Paul, the designs reflect the heart of the athlete and the spirit of the community. With rising defensive football stars Will Anderson and Chase Young on the roster, Clutch Athletics brings the best innovative gear to all athletes, giving them style and performance on and off the field. Learn more and purchase Clutch Athletics at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Cover 3 Podcast with your hosts, Chip Patterson and Barton Simmons. It's your call for the best college football coverage. From National Signing Day to the National Championship and everything in between, CBS Sports presents the Cover 3 Podcast.
And welcome back to the Cover 3 Podcast here on CBS Sports. It's that five-star content for your earbuds. Make sure that if you're hearing this for the first time, you go and subscribe, review, rate, tell us what you think, tell us how you feel. Because, listen, it's like full go. Barton Simmons, right here. I wake up in the mornings now, and I know that I'm starting to get into midseason form because the first thing I think about is talking to you.
Well, that's,
truly,
yeah, it's blushing over here.
Yeah, that's where we're at. How you doing?
I'm good. It's you know what's been fun this week is we are here on Wednesday morning. We are less than 24 hours away from recording our first locks pod, and I've been digging deep in my research. And this is I truly feel back when I can dig into my locks research and start hitting my bullet points and reasonings for winning some money. So I'm excited about locks tomorrow.
That's right. Breaking news. Tomorrow morning we will be recording the win totals edition of the locks podcast series. Tom Fornelli making his triumphant return. We've been discussing the legalities and making sure everybody gets on the same page all through the week so that when we sit down to record on Thursday, it's in the Thunderdome. We're just throwing these samurai swords at each other and seeing what's going to stick. I'll say, are you starting with a list that is growing, or are you starting large and then paring down prior to recording?
I've had multiple sessions of making big lists at varying points, and that list altering a little bit. And now I'm digging in and like getting into the ones I feel the most confident in among the big list. And then I do the research, and then I'd see if I've researched myself out of a pick. And so far so good. But right now I've just sort of researched the ones the no brainers for me. I gotta sort of parse out a couple of the bubble teams and figure out if how confident I feel.
Are you gonna drop Bowling Green under 3 on your on the locks pod?
I have no comment on that. We'll have to wait and see.
I took that one to I took that one to the friends. You know, I was out playing golf on Saturday, and I had to just propose that for the purposes of discussion, just to introduce what the sweat might be like for someone who knows almost nothing about Bowling Green. But it's like, if you really want to live this football season,
it is, because it's a beautiful bet, because it opens with Morgan State, the 8th best team in the MEAC, a likely win, and then you got just weeknight MAC games galore the rest of the year to just grind that thing out. So we'll see if I have the stones to pull the trigger on that.
All right. So another note from last week, the last episode, the first one of the week, is that we had in the process of editing, after we had finished recording, we had some clarity brought to the Miami quarterback battle, where Jaren Williams was announced as the starter for the season opener against Florida. Now, Miami does pretty much need to get ahead of this way before any of these other schools that are continuing their quarterback battles. Why? Well, because, you know, they're playing on August 24th. Everything's sped up. Everything's about a week ahead. But
that's not really where the drama wasn't over, because reports indicated that Tate Martell missed that day's practice. And given Tate Martell's exit from Ohio State after missing out on that starting quarterback job, and given, you know, Tate Martell's arrival at Miami, I think that brought up a very quick dive into discussions about college football and transfers. But plot twist, he was reported to be back at Miami's practice, back at the team meetings. And so before we get into, I guess what maybe was even kind of like a Kelly Bryant, Dabo Swinney-esque dive into let's just talk about transfer culture, let's talk about specifically Tate Martell, because Barton, you are an expert, and I was curious, and I wanted to sort of get you to expand on the idea that we should look at Tate Martell, particularly here at Miami, and understand that he probably has an opportunity to contribute, even if it's not as the QB1.
Well, I mean, there's that. You know, he was a contributor last year at Ohio State in goal line packages and sort of mobile quarterback packages that they put in to complement Dwayne Haskins. Now, I can't say that he ever really impacted games in that role, but they played him. I mean, they threw him in the red zone and had him take some snaps in meaningful moments. So there's that, there's that element. There's the idea that Jaren Williams is unproven himself, and is there a need to give the nod to another quarterback midway through the year? Is there, obviously there's injury issues. Let's look at the idea that, college football playoff teams over the last 3 years are regularly playing their backup, whether it's Jake Fromm or Tua or, we've seen backup quarterbacks in very meaningful roles in very meaningful games at the top of the food chain in college football. So there's just playing the role that I think is there as well. And hey, like there's even you could make a case that there's even a role for him if he wants to sort of be a slot receiver type of guy, if that's the direction he wants to go. But I just think the idea that Tate Martell being part of a team is probably pretty good for Tate Martell.
Like the slot receiver thing was what really interests me, because if Tate Martell wants to entertain that possibility and wants to take on that role, like, that shows, in my opinion, going back all the way to the QB1 documentaries and going back to some of the social media behavior, and certainly he's been a loud and divisive personality on the internets. I would take seeing him contribute in other ways within the Dan Enos' offense and being willing to take that on as a sign of, if not growth from where he is, at least a sign of some kind of maturity in terms of his commitment to Miami and trying to help the Hurricanes be the best football team that they can be. Because of his athletic ability, he ranks among the most athletic options out there on the field. And if he is comfortable getting in there and catching passes and making plays, like then man, that to me would speak a lot more to Tate Martell than what could be the next step in this scenario, which is that he just goes from Coral Gables to Boca Raton and links up with Lane Kiffin.
Yeah, that seems like the natural progression of things, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I do want to be very clear. There has been zero indication from anywhere that Tate Martell is actually considering a move to receiver, or that Miami is actually considering moving him to receiver. Like, that's purely just sort of a fun speculation of direction this could go.
Well, look, that's more grounded in as grounded in reality as him going to FAU. If we're going to get out here and fire off these, oh, Tate Martell's going to transfer again jokes, then I think it is worth being fair to Tate Martell to entertain the idea that he could put team before self and say, all right, I got it. Now what can I do? And like you mentioned, there is, like, Jaren Williams has been on campus. You know, he's a redshirt freshman. He's been on campus longer. He's been around the team longer. We called him the safe pick in the last podcast, but he wasn't named the starting quarterback for the entire season. Tate Martell could still go win this job by week three.
Yeah. But and it's funny, because everyone dogs on Tate Martell.
Everyone.
He's such a, you know, he's become this caricature of a cocky quarterback that's underachieved or like a bust even. And I kind of went on Twitter and I guess not defended him, but I sort of questioned, like, why do we really need to, like, bag on him this bad? And it was, and I said, I think I made a comment, like, it's bizarre to me how everyone hates Tate Martell. That was probably poorly worded. I totally get why people hate on Tate Martell. Like, he is such an easy target. He has created this for himself. And with the way he's acted on social media, in other quarterback battles, whether it be in high school, whether it be when Justin Fields transferred, and now when he doesn't show up at practice the day after Jaren Williams is named the starter, like, he is absolutely made himself a target for that. I think where I was sort of, and by the way, Chip, if you ever want to get your mentions popping, get that ticker going, throw some Tate Martell hot takes in your Twitter timeline. They'll be climbing, hanging, swinging from vines.
See, I was going to say, given the ecosystem on Twitter, I understand that you now are like, I do understand why people hate Tate Martell. I didn't frame it right. But given the ecosystem, I love that you had to start there. It's like, right, you had to be even stronger. Like, in case you are misreading this, I am defending Tate Martell.
but I think, like, my bigger point there is, here's the Twitter, and this is less college football talk and more social media talk, I guess. But one of my biggest, like, sort of pet peeves with Twitter is this idea that, like, we are all, as a Twitter community, called to, like, hold people accountable for their previous sins. Like, if somebody was overconfident and cocky and they get humbled, by God, we got to let them know. We have to make sure they feel it. And it's like, man, you know what? Tate Martell is being humbled without Twitter. Like, he's being humbled by the fact he's the backup dang quarterback yet again. The people I've talked to that are familiar with the quarterback room there, like, there's no defending him. Like, there's not like he's more humble than you realize. He's actually a pretty good guy. Like, I mean, he's got a reputation and he's lived up to that reputation, but I still don't think that, like, I don't feel called to bring Tate back down to earth. And I think the other thing, that the reason I was sort of felt compelled to tweet something was that Tate Martell is being painted as this major underachiever, like, hasn't lived up to the expectations, and he has certainly not surpassed or met expectations yet, but he is still in a situation where he got beat out by Dwayne Haskins, no big deal, first round draft pick, a guy who was ranked higher than him in high school. He left when Ohio State indicated they'd rather have Justin Fields than him. Number two quarterback in the country. Okay, understandable. And Jaren Williams was ranked, you know, Tate was ranked higher in the 24/7 Sports composite rankings, but in our rankings of 24/7 Sports, Jaren Williams is ranked higher than him. Like, Jaren Williams isn't some anonymous nobody that just beat out these guys. Jaren Williams is talented in his own right. And so the Tate Martell is a bust. While it's trending that way, like, let's let the guy, you know, let's give him a chance to maybe not be a bust somewhere along the way.
how dare you call for perspective? I mean, but and look, he's a redshirt sophomore,
like, right?
Like, is he a bust in that he's not a three and done off to be a first round pick in the NFL draft? Maybe, but I mean, he's still got a lot of college career left.
Yeah. And I don't want to even act like I'm defending our ranking. Like, that's not what this is about. I'm just saying, like, he's, like, if I had a do-over, we would rank him lower. But he's still got some games left in him and some decisions left to be made and some opportunity in front of him.
Elsewhere, a little bit of news when it comes to the starting quarterback. I love when we're able to get a little bit ahead of things, when we're able to drop just some knowledge in your earbuds in March that's going to end up paying off in August. And you heard here on the Cover 3 podcast that Jaden Daniels showed up to Arizona State's spring practice. He was an early enrollee, and he started to wow people right off the bat. And sure enough, Herm Edwards announces this week, Jaden Daniels will be the first true freshman starting quarterback in Arizona State football history. You kind of called your shot with Jaren Williams. You called your shot with Jaren Daniels. I'm nervous to go up against you in win totals locks because you're on a little bit of a hot streak with these quarterbacks.
I mean, the Jaden Daniels thing was kind of pretty. The writing had been on the wall here for going back to the spring. And keep in mind, Jaden Daniels, he was our, I think, number two rated quarterback coming out last cycle. So credit to Arizona State for A, getting him in. But B, I think, I mean, he was so productive in high school. He's so talented. And, you know, given that there was an opportunity there, like they treated him like a guy that they would trust with that job from the jump. And I think one thing that's interesting, too, about this this quarterback battle. Remember, Arizona State brought in three quarterbacks in the class, and that's obviously that's pretty uncommon. You don't see that very often. But I think one thing that's kind of neat about this is one of those guys, Ethan Long, is somebody that's really athletic, who they've already sort of started putting that. You know, he's played some quarterback, he's played some H-back, he's played some wing back, he's been on kickoff return team and punt protection team. And so they brought in three quarterbacks. One's going to start. One looks like he may be this all-purpose guy. And then the other one, Joey Yellen, is pretty good in his own right, apparently, and is at least maybe going to be a red shirt who's got a chance to develop and maybe take over when Jaden Daniels has the NFL. So I think the forward-thinking approach that Herm Edwards has had with this quarterback class seems to be really hitting. It helps that they landed maybe the best quarterback in the entire country, but Jaden Daniels is going to be a superstar in the Pac-12, and for them to now have what looks like a foundational piece of their offense moving forward for the next 3 years, you know, whether they get beyond seven wins this year, I don't know, but I think you can make some long-term bets on Arizona State right now with the way they're, you know, as many freshmen and youngsters as they played last year, and now with an offense that looks like it's going to grow around a really talented true freshman quarterback.
Would you guess that by the end of the year, would you have considered Dorian Thompson-Robinson's first year at UCLA to be a success, I guess? Or you maybe felt more comfortable at the end than you did at the beginning?
Sure.
Yeah, I wonder if we have a little bit of a Dorian Thompson-Robinson-like impact where, for example, Arizona State plays Michigan State in week two, one of the first 3 weeks of the season. And Jaden Daniels might get a little beat up by Michigan State. That might be a little bit tough going up against Mark D'Antonio. And for a freshman quarterback, that's not something that that is going to faze me if that ends up being a matchup that goes very much in the way of the Spartans' defense. But you come talk to the Pac-12 defensive coordinators in October and November, I could see that light bulb goes on, Jaden Daniels gets more comfortable, they get into conference play where you've got a little bit more familiarity from a game planning and a scheming standpoint. And I could see the Jaden Daniels that's playing in the Territorial Cup against Arizona and playing in some of those really crucial, are we going to be bowling games in late October, November. I think that's where I'm expecting Jaden Daniels to really start to pop and to have his name really start to resonate a little bit as one of the better quarterbacks in the Pac-12. I'm still going to shy away from claiming him to be one of the top, let's see. I'm still going to shy away from saying that, you know, he's a top two or three quarterback in the Pac-12, but I absolutely believe that by the end of the season, we could talk about him in that kind of way.
Well, I mean, like when you look at Dorian Thompson-Robinson last year, I mean, he enrolled in the summer, wasn't an early enrollee, wasn't even expected to be the starter. You know, they wanted Wilton Spate to be their starter for some unknown reason. and Jaden Daniels is a whole different deal. Like they brought him in, and almost from like week one of spring practice, you're already hearing like Jaden Daniels looks the best of all the quarterbacks. And so he's been sort of, in a lot of ways, the leader in the clubhouse since the second he got on campus. And he's been this perceived starter for 6 months now. And so I think he comes in with a little more command of the huddle, figuratively speaking, I guess, than maybe your typical true freshman that, you know, really takes this quarterback battle deep into fall camp. Like, hey, they named him early. It's obvious. Let's just roll with it. And I think that's going to benefit him and benefit Arizona State.
In some injury news, Josh McMillan is going to miss the whole season, right?
Yeah, man, he's out. And he was looking like the favorite to be the starter. He was a red shirt senior for Alabama. So he'll apply for a 6-year. He may have been a red shirt junior. So either way, I would expect him to probably get another year. But he was sort of not the most athletic, but the guy that's been there and knows the defense and can get everybody lined up and at a position that Alabama has really for a couple years now been trying to add some depth. For him to be out of the mix now, you know, maybe they go Shane Lee, a true freshman, you know, Ali Kaho, who was a late arrival last year, who was a 5-star but hadn't quite lived up to that yet. Maybe it's his time to step up. But either way, like it's just, I think that's another blow to an Alabama defense that is, I mean, the roles are flipped from what we're used to in Alabama. Yabia Noma, the former 5-star edge rusher, you know, transferred out. So they're just, you know, the defense is just, it's crumbling a little bit. Crumbling is strong. There is some cracks in the facade right now that they need to shore up.
But at this moment, I'm finding myself only being limited to identifying it as depth issues because
sure.
Our old pal Gary Danielson is the one who always makes the crack on the broadcast where he'll say, "Oh gosh, well just bring in another 5-star." I mean, they're phenomenally talented, but it is a numbers game, and when we start to get near, we have had times where you start to get near the end of the season and even Alabama is like, yeah, if we get, you know, one more injury on the offensive line, things are going to start to get a little shaky. If we get one more injury at linebacker, things might get a little shaky. And it seems like losing McMillan, who you mentioned has really been more of a contributor along the way, you know, there are probably more talented players that are going to come in behind him, but I'm still going to stop short of thinking that this is going to have a major impact right out the gate. I think that if we see like one or two linebackers go down with injuries, even if they're just small injuries, then all of a sudden, you know, that small margin between an Alabama and an LSU, an Alabama and an Auburn, an Alabama and a Texas A&M, all of a sudden those become places where those other teams are good enough to potentially exploit them. We just still think that even Alabama with Barton Simmons dropping down into the box, I think is still going to go 11-1.
Yeah, yeah. We grade them on such a different scale than just about everybody else in the country. Even Clemson to a degree. I mean, you know, if Clemson has a sort of a nobody, a middle linebacker, they've won with that before. I don't even and Alabama. You know, you look at the starters at some of their national championship teams, and there's a it's not like every guy is a future all pro. I mean, there's it's sprinkled in there with some guys that are selling insurance right now or selling yes. cars somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
not a lot, but there's a couple here and there. And so, you know, the idea that we sort of have this expectation that, oh, if it doesn't some name that we've been hearing percolating behind the scenes at Alabama is the next superstar, that all of a sudden they're hamstrung. No, they'll be okay. And especially when their offense is as generational as this one might in fact be. So, you know, the sky's not falling, but I do think it's just something to monitor as the season progresses. And, because this, I do think this is probably going to be another year where Alabama's, you know, they could give up 30 points here or there. Like it just isn't the old Alabama that's just going to smother you defensively and then run out the clock on offense.
No, but they do have some sick, like, I agree with you. They're not, the boa constrictor is not at all what I'm expecting from Alabama, but the athleticism behind, like, Dylan Moses is a phenomenal, like, outrageous football talent, but I love just thinking about, like, Patrick Surtain, Xavier McKinney. Like, they do have some freak players in the secondary too. So
yeah.
they might get diced up a little bit. They might give up 30 points, but I also feel like they've got the kind of playmaking where we might see just absurd plays being made by that back end to the safety valve of the defense.
Yeah, and they're because last year was the unknown was kind of the secondary, and those guys all played pretty well and grew up. And this year, you know, that's going to be the strength. The secondary is going to be the strength, and they'll lean on that. And I think their front as talented as they are on the defensive line, they're young, and so I think that might take some time. But they're ultimately going to be really good up front too. It just might not, you know, they may grow into that.
And Josh McMillan, he is the second season-ending injury that we've had so far. We mentioned it briefly, but running back Trey Sanders, former five-star, will miss the entire 2019 season with a foot injury that needed surgery. For Trey Sanders, the prospect, Trey Sanders, the player, is there any concern about you know, this being something within a pattern or what it might mean for him moving forward?
No, I don't think so. He's been healthy, productive. I think he famously said he was going to win a Heisman as a freshman, which is bold coming into that running back room. But he'll have to wait on that. But he may have a better chance at that Heisman when he comes back out next year, because there's only so many carries to go around already with Najee Harris and Brian Robinson. Brian Robinson is sort of being termed as like the most underused piece of the offense last year based on how talented he is and how few touches he was able to get. So he'll have some breakout of potential. And Najee Harris is the former five-star, is ready for the load this year. So that is not a spot where, unfortunate for Trey Sanders, but that's not a spot where Alabama is going to be hurting at the running back position.
Keeping it in the SEC West, Texas A&M freshman tight end Baylor Cup suffered a broken ankle. He is, quote, out for a while, could miss the entire season. This is particularly disappointing for Cup. He was the number one tight end in the 2019 class. And with him stepping in and Jace Sternberger going on to the NFL, there was absolutely the door open where you're looking at Jimbo Fisher's offense. You're seeing the way that Kellen Mond was able to get into a rhythm, just firing it down the seam to Sternberger. Like, you could absolutely see Baylor Cups being a high impact freshman in the SEC. He goes down with this injury. What's your read on this in terms of how it adjusts, if at all, sort of your view of the Texas A&M offense?
I think this hurts Texas A&M and more than most true freshmen hurt most places, because this kid was he was our number one tight end in the country, five-star guy. He's 6'6", 250 or something, and he runs a 22 500 or 200 meter, which is just smoking, and just a rare athlete. Made some big plays in the spring game. He was going to be a starter. He was going to be a big part of the offense. And Jimbo Fisher wants to, the tight end is a big part of what Jimbo Fisher wants to do. They still got another true freshman that's pretty good, and Jalen Weidermeyer. who's still going to, I think, make an impact. But I think Baylor Cup was about to be an immediate national name in college football as a true freshman. Unfortunately, I think that injury sounds like that injury is pretty gnarly. Sounds like it was pretty like nasty and significant. So I would imagine the idea that he would come back at all this season is out of the picture, and just hope he recovers fully. But so disappointing that we just can't see him and can't see A&M with him lined up as a tight end. But I don't think it drastically changes their hopes for what the season can become. But that's not a insignificant injury though.
I'm gonna call my shot here. 6'6", 245 pounds, the pride of Brock, Texas. We're talking about an iconic Texas A&M tight end.
You may want to wait till that rehab gets through before we start going iconic shots on.
I love the idea that there's iconic Texas quarterbacks and the Jimbo Fisher era will be defined by iconic Texas A&M tight ends.
I think if that happens, Jimbo Fisher probably be pretty happy. If he can make a tight end iconic, that probably means they're playing some pretty good football.
You got any other notes from around the country before we toss it on over to Dennis Dodd?
I think that's your injury report for the week of August 12th.
Coming up on the other side, breaking down the war on football with the Dodd father next.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The magic bullet they now have in their holster, which they will apply. Nick Saban and Jim Harbaugh make a combined $20 million this season. Those two guys alone will make $13 million more than the entire MAC.
And now it's our pleasure to welcome back to the show Dennis Dodd, senior college football columnist for CBSSports.com, chief voice on CBS Sports HQ, and of course a regular here on the Cover 3 podcast. Dennis, You had a long time on the road this summer. You did the SEC media days. You did the Big Ten media days. There was, you've been in summits and symposiums. You moved your son out to Corvallis. Like you've really, really racked up the hotel and the flight points this summer.
Or used points as well too.
Oh, there we go. Like a true pro.
And one side note. On that trip to Oregon to settle in, my son saw about one quarter of the Mountain West. He's like me. We had to stop at these campuses just to see what they were like. And Colorado State was cool. And Colorado was cool. And we went to Utah. Where else did we go? I'm trying to remember. But
Wyoming? Did you make a Wyoming stop?
Made a side trip to Wyoming, went to Boise. And I hadn't been... I'd never been to Colorado State. The other ones I had, but it was fun seeing him enjoy these places as much as I did. You know, there's where Dad was covering the 2002 Winter Olympics at Rice-Eccles, which still has kind of the little banner there that the Olympics were there. So it's kind of cool.
That's awesome. Did you get to see the new Belgium Fat Tire beer deck at Colorado State Stadium?
Yes, we absolutely did. great story. It was locked. We're walking around in the stadium and it's locked. And we go up this ramp and my son just hits a button and this door opens, this mechanical door. And I go, okay. So we walk in and you know, took pictures and didn't go down to the field, could have, but didn't want to press our luck. But yeah, that the new Belgium Fat Tire Beer Garden or whatever it's called is really cool at one end of the stadium. They've done a great job there.
All right, so we got a lot to that we can get to, a lot that we will get to, but I want to start at a story that you have been working on throughout this offseason, because I think all the way back at maybe the AFCA conventions, I think even in January at the beginning of the year was where some of the discussions, some of them here on the Cover 3 podcast, others off air, just the idea that the coaching community was really starting to get concerned and vocal about the narratives and the way that the media in particular is framing football and the future of football and the phrases like football under attack. You know, I think, yeah, you know, sort of first started, I guess Larry Fedora at ACC Football Kickoff might be our patient zero here. But, you know, just as we start to dig into it, like when, at what point did you feel like you had enough either commentary from coaches or from others within the community to feel like this was becoming really one of the defining discussions off the field in college football?
Yeah, well, you named all the main parts of it. But for me, it kind of tipped over the edge when, and not many people know this, you guys remember this, it was in, well, it was last year, actually, when the football-playing JUCOs in Arizona shut down because of cost and insurance. And while that's a small part of the story, in my story, it reverberated around the football world. Like any head coach who's worth anything has passed through these JUCOs because it's talent rich. Barton, you know that. And it was a group of players sued, a discrimination lawsuit, in other words, alleging you took these opportunities away from African Americans. And I talked to one of the coaches who'd lost his job when they shut down these schools. And I said, okay, this is where we are. Football is changing before our eyes. And I guess the angle was, we're all forced to like take a side, whether it's, you know, football needs to change, it's not safe, or, hey, might as well put skirts on them. You know, you had that faction. What are you doing to the game? And it really did start, Chip, last summer. You chronicled it well with Larry Fedora saying, you know, football's under attack, and then added it's what did he say? He added, you know, it's the downfall of our culture.
He said that great generals and great military leaders learned from football, and that if football goes down, our country is going to go down too.
Yeah. So you've got that faction. You've got the story. My story starts out with Steve Hatchell, the executive director of the National Football Foundation, in a meeting with American Athletic Conference administrators and coaches earlier this year. And I was allowed in because I asked, and he starts off, his first statement is, "The New York Times has a real penchant against the game of football. They are smart, they are strategic, and they are mean." That's what he chose to lead with in his discussion of the National Football Foundation. So somewhere, somebody thinks the media is part of this. I personally never thought that the New York Times had it out for anybody. We could, you know, we could talk politics till the day is long, but in terms of football, I thought they covered it well and broke a lot of stories. But that just gives you one idea of how people perceive football these days. There's a trustee at Colorado who said, Mel Tucker, introductory press conference, Mel Tucker said, "My dad taught me one thing about football, to hit, hit, hit. You know, we're going to be physical." Based on that statement, a trustee who was responsible for approving his contract at Colorado didn't. She was put off by the statement. She goes, "I don't think football is safe. If I had friends, I wouldn't allow a child to play football. That's the very first thing that has to be eliminated. She wants to turn Folsom Field into soccer fields." So that's where we are. I mean, you're either on one side of this extreme or the other, it seems to me. I should mention the participation numbers are at record lows. Certainly not in the Southeast, but across the country, and particularly California. So there's a problem there.
So where do you, Dennis, with the people you've talked to, because there is a level of just sort of amplification of these voices that are against it. And I'm curious whether you think how legitimate is the fear of the football attack? Like, how legitimate is the movement, however real that is, to sort of tamp out football? What legitimacy do you place in it?
Yeah, I think we, as this discussion has grown, and it's really based, I should mention, it's really based on, you know, when head trauma became a thing. How many years ago you want to put on that? I don't know, 10, 15, 5, I don't know. You still have that far right wing faction, and again, not politics, but just conservative views that football, you know, is a leader of men. It develops generals. It develops leaders. The other part of this is, I think we're going to have to accept that the game is changing before our eyes for the better. I think it's the NCAA, whether forced to or on their own, has done a great thing in this partnership with the Department of Defense, where I think in general, I think we all admit that there's less hitting in football. There's going to have to be less hitting because the math doesn't add up. You know, the less you hit, the more chance you have of injuring yourself, never mind your head. That's why the NFLPA has negotiated in the collective bargaining agreement that they go full pads less than once a week during a season. In college football, it's spread. The Big 12 and Pac-12 at least have a limit on fully padded practices, which are 2 a week. And I've told coaches around the country, well, we don't do that anyway because of the concern about injuries. So it's just, you know, and I think sooner or later we're going to see the end of kickoffs because the numbers there are so tilted in favor of injuries. In other words, per capita, there are more injuries on kickoffs, more catastrophic injuries than any other play. You know, you're talking about maybe 5 kickoffs and 140 plays. There's more injuries per capita on kickoffs. I think that in time will be eliminated. But it's just, you know, I'm okay with all that. But I think there's another faction here, you know, don't take our game away from us. And it's changing before our eyes.
There's, as I hear you talk about it, like this is, it almost, I hope this isn't delved too much into political talk, but I'm looking at this as sort of a parallel of like the NRA's fight for gun control in terms of like, they don't want to give an inch because they think 1 inch is just going to lead to the dam breaking and then all the guns being removed. Whereas, you know, football in a way, I mean, it's, there's been progress in making the game safer. And I guess the fear is, hey, once you know, remove kickoffs and then what's next no tackling in practice. And then what are we doing? So I guess there's that sort of, holding of the line and where do you draw that line and what do you allow if you're on the obviously the pro football side of things what do you allow in terms of the safety measures and what do you push back against?
That's a great point to just dial this one factor in. This is a huge discussion point in football right now. When is a good time for kids to play tackle football? Pop Warner sponsors tackle football at age 5. There are state associations that don't allow it till high school, I'm talking about, that don't allow it till high school or junior high. Who's right? I don't know. I guess I have my problems with age 5, but, you know, we don't know what we don't know for sure about head trauma. Repetitive hits are bad. But did, you know, juniors say I'll die because of football? No one can say that for sure. I talked to Aaron Taylor, the analyst on CBS Sports Network, who was great. He's got some great insight. He's had 6 friends who played pro football commit suicide. And he said, including very close to Junior Seau. And he admitted, you know, that you can't say for sure whether football caused this, you know, to the point that this whole head trauma discussion started with Mike Webster. He was like patient zero. He was in there. Who's the doctor? Dr. Ben, who discovered CTE, and he cites Mike Webster in that movie or in the reporting. Mike Webster is widely known, had a and he lived under a bridge. He was homeless. Widely known as a person to be a drug and alcohol abuser. Well, did that have play into his CTE and his brain problems? I would think it would say yes. He also played center in Pittsburgh for years for the Steelers. So we don't know what we don't know, and that contributes to the conversation, to the argument.
The message I've heard from people that have I've got friends that played in the league that have studied this, and the message I've heard in terms of some of the studies is that sort of the early playing of football is not good because these kids are just sort of bobbleheads out there,
right?
You know, and they're these huge heads and the neck can't control it. And so there's that level of it. But also, like, I remember when I was trying to petition my parents to let me play, they wouldn't let me play forever because it was, you know, I finally was, you know, convinced them to let me play in sixth grade. But before that, it was, it's too dangerous. And I guess maybe that was more in that era is more about like the fear of paralysis.
Yeah.
So in some cases, I feel like we're forgetting that there's always been this pushback for football and the danger, quote, of the sport. And so I'm really curious as this thing continues to progress and more studies come out, if because you hear all the pro football side talk about this game has never been safer. And I think there's probably some truth to that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
There's
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say often discouraged at choose a side type discussions and debates. And I am encouraged at some of the few coaches that I know anecdotally that from speaking to them at media functions or media availabilities on the record, off the record, like there mm-hmm. there is within college football, I know those approaches that say we are always open to receiving more information. We are always going to encourage more research to be done. And when recommendations come down about ways to make this game safer, and Barton, to follow up, oftentimes it comes with that line, the game has never been safer, and we are always open to making changes. You know, I hope that there is that that growing middle ground in terms of not having, like, I would hate to think that in the coaching community, it's turned into a whose side are you on situation.
Yeah, I agree. There's other parts of this. Attendance is down, whether, you know, the product is good, but it's very expensive and the experience is not the best to spend 4 hours or 7 hours or 8 hours at a college game. I was going to mention one thing. The insurance has become huge. There was a compelling story in February in ESPN.com about how a lot of football entities, Pop Warner and some others, couldn't get insurance. There were like two companies in the country that were writing policies for football. So that's tough.
So what is the concern for a payout on the insurer? Is that just like a class action? Like
I always say this, and we all pay for insurance. Those insurance companies aren't in the business of writing you checks. You know, that they have to make money. So they pay those, you know, you pay those premiums more than you probably have to, so they can make money. If there are enough, you know, they're looking at this, if there are enough head trauma lawsuits and settlements, and they have to end up paying those insurance premiums or medical cases, they stop making money. So, it just becomes, you know, why would you insure a Willenda on a high wire? You know, they're very good, but if they fall once, that's a big loss. So, but in the piece, I know it is getting better. I did talk to John Butler, who's the head of Pop Warner, and he said, yeah, it was down to two people who would insure any entity. Now it's gotten a little bit better as they've gotten their arms around this. As we just said, it is safer. The numbers prove it. I didn't even get into the helmet thing. Apparently there's a revolution in helmets now where they differ by position, which I guess was surprising to me. They're much safer now. And if you can prove that to an insurer, then that's going to bring the premiums down and bring them back into the market.
Yeesh. Crazy stuff. Yeah. All right. We've been filling out some ballots for CBSSports.com. The CBS Sports 2019 All-America team went up on Tuesday. On Wednesday, our all-time CFB 150 all-time All-Americans Let's say Barton, you first. With the CBS Sports, the 2019 CBS Sports preseason All-Americas, was there any position where you found yourself struggling with it in terms of making your cuts or decisions, and as you look at the final team, were there any differences or places where you want to call attention?
I would say one spot that was maybe my most interesting internal debate was what to do with the first team quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
And it might actually be a little bit of a different discussion than you guys may have had internally. I was toying with making Sam Ehlinger my first team quarterback over Trevor Lawrence.
Wow. Whoa.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, 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 yes.
It's a bet on, I mean, Trevor, if Clemson puts Chase Bryce in at quarterback, they're probably still going undefeated. Whereas Sam Ehlinger, if Texas somehow goes 12-0 or 11-1, which is in the realm of possibility, it will be almost wholly because of what Sam Ehlinger has done and like some heroics that he's accomplished. And so that was my debate, was just sort of like how hard am I willing to go for my guy Sam Ehlinger? And ultimately I went Trevor 1, Ehlinger 2. 2 obviously would have been right there as well, but I think that's going to be an interesting horse race to track there.
I hadn't even considered Sam Ehlinger for the first team spot, but you raised some good points. I think that's interesting. You really think Chase Bryce would have beaten Alabama?
I'm saying this year's team. I think Clemson could probably go 12-0 with Chase Bryce.
What happens
in the playoffs? You know, that's right. Probably a little bit more of a stretch. But in terms of this season, this regular season was kind of the way I was looking at it. I would have no hesitation picking Clemson every game with Chase Bryce.
And here's why I picked Trevor Lawrence. I racked my brain and I wrote a story about it. The last time I saw a freshman that I thought could play in the league right now. And it was based on his body of work, particularly obviously the championship game, where he said, this guy should be in the NFL right now. And I couldn't think of one. I mean, there are some, but all the guys I looked up, Dan Marino, Elway, some others as freshmen just didn't have the impact that Trevor Lawrence did in 7 or 8 games that they had in entire seasons. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So that was my rationale.
I've got you guys know I'm already way too big on my Oklahoma Jalen Hurts bet, so I think I might have had Jalen Hurts in there too. Dennis, what about you? Any positions where you really struggled or where you felt like you might not be just moving along with the rest of the pack?
No, I didn't have a problem with it. I'm glad Rondale Moore made all purpose because obviously one of the receivers, he needs to be in there. I really like Patty Fisher, the living incarnation of Pat Fitzgerald at Northwestern, by the way. I asked him that at the Big Ten media. Yes, people have said I'm his child, plays the same position, volume tackler, same name almost, good old boy. So no, I really didn't, just because when the team came out, yep. Those were basically the guys I picked. The Missouri tight end was a bit of a surprise, but I think people see that he was injured a lot last year. Help me out here. Albert Okwugbunam, I think is a redshirt junior, was injured a lot last year in Drew Locke's last season. I think he's really going to prosper in that offense again with Kelly Bryant this year. So no, I was good with it.
I think we've got a way in there. I think it's maybe Okwugbunam.
Okay. All right.
We're all working on it. Barton, you want to take a stab?
I'm a Missoula alum. I should know this.
I was going to say, Dennis.
I know.
Yeah,
you should
be the expert here.
I know.
We're all zeroed in on Rondale Moore, and Rondale Moore is fantastic. First player in Big Ten history to be a unanimous freshman All-American. He was outstanding. But I am willing, like when we talked about it on CBS Sports HQ on Tuesday, I was trying to circle names from the second team that I could end up seeing as first team picks. I could see Jalen Waddle surpassing Rondale Moore for top all-purpose player, and I could see AJ Epenesa from Iowa making a jump to being more of a first team defensive line pick. And then I could see Micah Parsons just having an absolute like explosion year at Penn State on a defense that, while it doesn't have many certain names, there's no lack of talent. And I think that we end up learning some of those playmakers pretty soon. And the Parsons has got to be one of them.
I've talked to some people around Penn State, you know, since that staff has been there. It's sort of Saquon Barkley and then a huge gap and then everybody else in terms of just sort of flash talents, pure raw ability. And they're saying that Micah Parsons is like getting to be on that Saquon Barkley tier in terms of just what he can accomplish, what he looks like athletically, the competitiveness that he brings every day. So he was a first teamer on my ballot. I think he's going to be a dude this year. The one other guy, and I mean, I think this year at wide receiver is phenomenal. Like, I didn't even have Rondale Moore on my wide receiver ballot, and I fully acknowledge he's good enough to be a first teamer. I actually had Jerry Jeudy 1, Laviska Shenault 2, Justin Ross 3, Tylan Wallace 4, but there's like all kinds of different wide receiver combinations I think are defensible as long as Jerry Judy's in there somewhere.
Yeah, you could have two Alabama receivers in first team.
You could have your top four guys as Alabama receivers.
Yeah, they've got the best set of receivers in the country, which I never thought those words would come from my mouth, but you know, I never thought Nick would run RPOs either. That's another story. I haven't looked this up, it just struck my mind. When's the last time the Biletnikoff winner returned? You know, I'm sure there's one out there, but you know, to have the best receiver in the country return is something for Alabama. And there, I will say this, not to open up another can of worms, I think Jerry Judy's numbers are going to go down because Nick Saban is going to reel Tua in a little bit, and even with the injuries, is going to run Najee Harris and Brian Robinson more, just to develop more of a power running game. Go ahead.
Well, I would say on that though, there's some buzz coming out Alabama camp that there's going to be a lot more 10 personnel, 4 wide stuff because of their lack of a tight end. Right. So they lost Irv Smith, Kendrick. I can't remember. They got a transfer guy to SMU, and the guys on Miller Forrestall has been a little bit banged up in the preseason. And so they don't have as proven a tight end option as they're used to having. So while I agree with you that they, you know, the real and Tua end thing seems to be kind of the approach, they're going to be really tempted to just, you know, spread those guys out, go 4 wide with the 4 best receivers in the country and dare someone to figure out a way to you know, who, pick your poison, you know, who are you not double.
Right. Yeah. There's nobody on that schedule. It looks like they can do that consistently, but I will say this, they, you know, you can run power out of that set, which I think he'll just do more of. Chip Kelly did use a tight end in his 4 wide and his spread. Others don't at his base. That's what Gus Malzahn wants to do, is run power out of the spread. With a quarterback situation this year, I don't know which way that's headed, because they're going to be a defensive minded team. So no, you can do it, but if that's the case, Barton, it's even going to be more entertaining than Alabama. That's going to be fun to watch, but Tua has to make better decisions. I think we all understand that. He thought he could score a touchdown on every pass sometimes, and sometimes a check down is a win.
There were a solid 8 games where the evidence that was presented to Tua by his own actions suggested he could score on every play.
Sure.
there was a big portion of that season where he would just sit back and just wait for Jerry Jeudy to get free 60 yards down the field.
Sure.
Just let it go. Also on CBSSports.com, we released our College Football Turns 150 all-time All-America team. It was a daunting task to fill this out. I don't have but a set collection of college football knowledge for me to draw from my own lifetime. So I will admit that it was a little bit of a research project, but one that I certainly enjoyed doing as an appreciator of this sport and all of its fantastic history. I did probably lean a little bit more towards the recognizable names on my own ballot, but man, it was fun to be able to dig in there and make a good argument for a Leroy Selman, for a Hugh Green, for a Dick Butkus. So Dennis, you actually wrote the story. So how did you feel confident and comfortable with the way that the final All-America all-time team came out?
Yeah, I did. I mean, there was some, as you mentioned, some tremendous arguments to be made and decisions to be made. I thought the collective mind, us, did a really good job. The voting goes back all the way to 1964 and goes as far as 2009. Most recent player in the all-time team was Ndamukong Suh of Nebraska. 64, I think, was Tommy Nobis at Texas. So if that's recency bias, it's recency bias. You know, I didn't have Davey O'Brien on there. What do you do with a guy like him, you know, who's one of the all-time greats, played in the 30s at TCU? What do you do with Timmy Chang, who's number two in passing at Hawaii? I was shocked when I looked it up. The all-time leading passer in history is Case Keenum. You know, what do you do with him? I don't think he'd be in the top two, but that's the kind of decisions you had to make. Steve McNair at Alcorn State, who played down a division. You know, I had Tommy Frazier as my quarterback, but Tim Tebow could easily be the guy. You know, he won two championships. So did Tommy Frazier. Tim Tebow, I think, I want to say 119 total touchdowns or maybe more than that. But I don't know if I've ever seen a better option quarterback than Turner Gill for pure ability. So it was really, really hard.
You know, one of my big, like, crystallizations of going through this process and like kind of eye-opening, and not that I didn't know this, but the amount of all-time greats that Pitt has produced, that are candidates for like every position there was some Pitt all-time great, and even if they didn't make my team, they were sort of in the running. And it's sort of it helps you kind of remember and acknowledge that, you know, some of the teams and programs that have really produced talent at a really high level consistently. And the other one was, I mean, we all know this, but like, it was, I think my top two safeties were Ed Reed and Sean Taylor, like, you know, guys that played in Miami, in the same era. So, it was an impossible task, but it was kind of fun to dig into it.
You're talking about Tony Dorsett, Hugh Green at Pitt.
Dan Marino, Mike Ditka.
What do you do with those guys?
Larry Fitzgerald.
Larry Fitzgerald, too, who would be in a lot of people's all-time list. I had, on the safeties, I had Ronnie Lott. That was the hardest position, I think, just to come up. Ronnie Lott, Ed Reed, Kenny Easley, and Jack Tatum were my four safeties. We had to pick four. Jack Tatum was, you know, besides being one of the most physical safeties in the country, you know, a lot of these guys, their NFL careers were greater than their college careers because they played longer than the pros. But Jack Tatum was one of the most physical players that anyone has seen as a safety. Kenny Easley was a tactician, I think, at UCLA. What do you say about Ed Reed, who was less about the Miami swag and more about just pure production. And Ronnie Lott, who, like, you know, we all know the story about him having his pinky amputated to get back in the game. That was while he was a pro. Is maybe the best of all time at that position.
My flaming hot submission is that I left Tim Tebow off my ballot.
Tim Tebow wasn't on my ballot either. I caught a lot of heat from Silverstein. You guys might not like this either, but my first team quarterback, it's maybe a controversial pick, but I had Cam Newton as my first team.
I don't have a problem.
Let's go.
I don't have a problem with that. I told our esteemed editor who you just mentioned, I said, since I've been working at CBSSports.com, the two best players I've seen are Cam Newton and Tim Tebow. The best player I've ever seen is Barry Sanders, but that was 30 years ago. So I don't have a problem with that at all. I mean, we can talk about the off-field stuff, but that's not, you know, considered here. He was awesome. Cam was awesome.
Undisputed, owned the sport for an entire season.
Yeah.
and won a daggum national title doing it.
It was a one year deal. So, you know, if you're making it a career award, I guess there's other better arguments to be made. But I still think this is like the best, most dominant season that I've ever seen in my, you know, in my window.
You know who else, real quick, you know who else is in that category? Is Michael Vick, who, you know, he single-handedly kept Virginia Tech, almost beat Florida State by himself in that championship game. If you watch the game, you know, Florida State had better talent, but Vick just, I called it the Vick flick. He could flick his wrist and get that ball down the field. I remember watching him at Miami. It may have been that season or the season after in the old Big East, where he was limited by an ankle, and you could tell. It's like, boy, this guy at full strength, Virginia Tech wins this game. And he almost willed him to victory on one of those hot, steamy fall days at Miami with half a, you know, half a leg. But I'll never forget watching him in his brief, was it, God, 2 years that he started? I can't remember.
I think it was a redshirt sophomore.
Yeah.
He was, let's see, Michael Vick.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all good stuff. I did not have Michael Vick. My argument was for Roger Staubach. Get at me. Support the troops.
Yeah.
You can check out the all-time All-America team over on CBSSports.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Dennis.CBS. You can follow him at Barton Simmons. You can follow me at Chip_Patterson. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.